Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress Manicure and Press-On Falsies.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Morgan Murray is a talented writer currently based in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Originally from Caroline, Alberta, Murray has also lived his life in places like St. John's, Newfoundland, Montreal, Quebec, and Prague in the Czech Republic. Some of those experiences inform his brilliantly funny and compelling debut novel, Dirty Birds, which is out now via Breakwater Books, And sometime this past May, Morgan and I connected for a talk about the COVID-19 pandemic. His talented partner in life, the cartoonist, Kate Beaton, Leonard Cohen's character in Dirty Birds, and what this novel is really all about, his future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at MasseyHall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Zaki Ibrahim, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 551st episode of Creative Control, featuring the wonderful writer Morgan Murray, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Morgan. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. I'm well enough. Doing okay here in Edmonton. Where in the world are you?
I'm in just outside of Mabou, Cape Breton, on a farm my wife and I moved on to this past October. So we're about as isolated as you can possibly get.
And how is that for you, given that we are now all kind of isolated, self-isolating, as it were? How has it been to be on your, you know, voluntarily isolated, and now we're in a zone where it's kind of, you know, prescribed that you remain isolated?
Yeah, our day-to-day hasn't changed a lot. I'm on parental leave right now. We had a baby almost a year ago as of today, and so I've been, my wife is self-employed, so she couldn't take leave, so I took the whole meal deal, and so I've been off wearing sweatpants for a year now, and We're living in the middle of nowhere, near nothing. So it's been, our day-to-day has been fairly ordinary for us. But whenever we have to go to the big city of 3,000 people up the road and get groceries or things like that, the real world kind of rears up. And you see people in masks and everybody kind of giving each other side eye, trying to avoid everybody. And that kind of brings you back to reality pretty quickly.
And now this is in Nova Scotia, which is known in Canada as one of the places with the nicest population in the whole country, and you're saying people are a little paranoid. There's a little bit of an edge to the populace. Fair enough.
Yeah, there's a little bit more than we're used to, for sure. It's definitely very, very friendly ordinarily, and there's still every once in a while an old timer will come up and pat you on the back, and you have to run away because they don't believe in the 6-foot rule, but
and
where we are, we're in a very small community where my wife grew up, so she knows everybody, and we still, you know, you wave at your neighbors as you go by and all that stuff, but we've been keeping to ourselves and keeping our distance from everyone as we've been told.
Okay, so you're managing okay.
Yeah, we're hanging in there.
Okay, now normally when someone invokes their wife or their spouse on the show, I don't often follow up and say, it's worthwhile mentioning who your wife or partner is. That is not to disparage anyone on the show previously and their respective relationship. However, I must ask in this case for you to perhaps talk a little bit about your wife. Who is your wife? What does she do? You said she was self-employed. Can you expand upon that?
Yes. My wife is Kate Beaton, the cartoonist and author and national treasure. I still can't believe she agreed to marry me, but she did, and here we are. And she's in the dining room as we speak working on a really brilliant graphic novel, and she's got a phone call later with some Hollywood folks about some TV shows and stuff. So she's playing in a whole other league than me, and it's interesting and inspiring to watch her at work, for sure.
She is highfalutin. I will tell you that my wife, who is I also believe is very special and unique, has purchased numerous copies of Kate's work. It's called Hark the Vagrant, right?
Yes, that's her comic series.
That's right. So there's a book version of it. Is that right? It's a graphic novel called Hark the Vagrant. Yeah. So my wife has purchased many copies of this book over the years and given them away as gifts. We've kept one. At least one is still somewhere in our stuff, which is, as I'm speaking to you, in a moving storage facility. But anyway,
yeah.
Just so you know, we're big fans of your wife here, if I might say.
You've got good taste.
As do you. As do you, if I might say. Yeah, she's wonderful. Well, I'm glad. And so she's able to work. You mentioned you're on a leave. Do you have a day job, per se?
Yes. By day, I'm the innovation director for the Regional Economic Development organization, nonprofit here in Cape Breton. So
okay.
Running around trying to help people start businesses and things like that, which is a long way from writing a book.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, we'll get into this wonderful book of yours. It's called Dirty Birds in a moment. But I do want to kind of track your trajectory a little bit as it might relate to the primary character in your book, whose name is Milton Ontario, which is the name of a small city in Ontario called Milton, which I'm very familiar with, as a matter of fact. Now, before we get into that, though, you and I, when did we first interact? We've met, how many times have we met? I don't even know, Morgan.
Oh, two or three or five or several.
Okay.
we met in St. John's. There's a, when I lived in Newfoundland for almost a decade. I started off in grad school, and then I found out if you stick around a university long enough, they'll give you a job. So I worked at Munn for the rest of the time I was there. And there was a healthy Guelph expat community at Munn at the time that I became friends with, and you were friends with some of them, I think, and you ended up out there for different things, and we crossed paths a few times, I think.
I was there primarily and only, actually. I used to travel there annually for the Lanya Vanya Arts and Music and Culture Festival that my initially was organized by my friends Matthias Kamm and Ariel Sherritt, who are in the Burning Hell. And then some Guelph people were involved in that as well. People I knew from Guelph were also involved in that as well. So yeah, that's how I came to visit Newfoundland, as I say, annually. And then you and I, what was our interaction? Was it just the ships in the night? We were just saying hello, meeting each other?
No, I at the time organized a monthly art variety show happening event kind of thing called Words in Edgewise. And so each Lanya Vanya, each year, I would do an event in conjunction with the festival. And I think for a few of those, you were either a guest or a guest host or participated in some fashion in the event I helped organize. So I think that's primarily how we interacted at the time.
Okay. I was trying to remember exactly what our interactions were like, because I remember them, but I also was like, how? It was a bit of a blur every trip I made there. They had me doing lots of different things, which was great.
St. John's is usually a blur.
Okay, so you were out there for school, but where are you from originally?
I grew up on a farm in central Alberta, a beef farm.
Okay, so not too far from where I am as I'm speaking to you, I imagine.
No, we're about 2.5 hours from Edmonton.
Right, okay. So you're close to Edmonton, and then you've traveled around quite a bit. Where are some of the places you've lived? We mentioned Newfoundland. You mentioned Cape Breton, where you are now.
Yep.
Where else have you lived?
Before I was in Newfoundland, I lived in Montreal for about a year and a half. Before that, I did a Canadian Studies degree at the University of Calgary. In the middle of that, I lived for a year in Prague, in the Czech Republic, doing a term abroad kind of thing.
That's okay. So that one is a bit odd to me, because my wife's family is from Prague.
Oh, no way.
Her father is from Prague. Yeah. So that's kind of weird. It's a small world situation is all I'm getting at there.
Yeah. Prague is a wonderful place. Have you been?
No, I haven't yet been. I say yet knowing full well I'll never get to go now because of the world situation. But yes, no, we plan to go at some point, but no, I've never been. It's beautiful, right?
It's absolutely beautiful. They, just because of where it is, geographically during all the wars and stuff, it never got flattened like all the other European cities.
Right.
So it's got a lot more sort of diverse architecture and historical things than a lot of other places. And it's also dirt cheap. It was a lot cheaper for me to live in Prague, like Richie Rich, than to live in Calgary like a poor student. So it was a wonderful time.
Nice. Nice. Well, that's so, yeah. So you're something of a traveler. It's fair to say you are easily, is that fair to say you easily adapt to new environments and can easily become a resident without too much fuss?
I would say the opposite, but I get around. I okay, kind of so lurk in the backgrounds of a lot of places.
I bring this up because the central character, we alluded to him earlier, Milton Ontario, does some traveling in this wonderfully funny book, Dirty Birds. Can you, first of all, summarize what Dirty Birds is all about for those who have yet to read it and may be interested in reading it? What is this book all about?
Sure. It's a story of Milton Ontario, not to be confused with Milton Ontario. And Milton is fresh out of college, and he grew up in rural Saskatchewan and went to college in Moose Jaw. And once he graduates, he hops on a bus and goes to Montreal to become a famous poet like his hero Leonard Cohen. And things don't quite work out for poor Milton, and to say the very least.
Yeah, that is safe to say. Now, so I tried to connect you, Morgan, to Milton a little bit in terms of just traveling around, and you know, the implicit notion when anyone travels around is they are kind of trying to find themselves, establish themselves as a person. Do you relate to Milton on a personal level?
Absolutely. It's not fully autobiographical, but it borrows a lot, or sort of uses my own life as a point of departure. The naive kid from rural prairies and who moves to the big city to become a famous poet or artist or whatever, and kind of hops around looking for that thing that kind of gives him meaning and purpose is definitely familiar to me. And so that's kind of where I started off with Milton, but I don't think there's anything worse than having to read somebody's diary about finding themselves. So I spiced it up a little bit to hopefully make it more interesting and explore a few more general and broader ideas in the book.
Now, there's a lot of different kinds of polarity going on in Dirty Birds, dynamics, just situations that where you're kind of forced to reckon with passion versus practicality, reality versus romanticism, I suppose, these kinds of things. Do you think you're saying something in particular about the romanticization of art, in terms of how that might relate to real world practicalities and, you know, trying to live a sustainable life, while still maintaining your dreams? Is any of that floating around in this story?
For sure. And, you see it mostly with Milton in his relentless pursuit of fame and fortune through poetry, which I don't think is a thing, but he sticks to it very doggedly. And just this notion of he sort of immerses himself in this bubble in Montreal around the plateau and Mile End, which is when I lived there especially, which is when I set this book, because that was my experience and something I could talk with a little bit of knowledge about. There's this strange sort of Anglophone bubble in the heart of Montreal, where there's a lot of McGill and Concordia students and a lot of, you know, just people who were part-time baristas, part-time musicians and things. And it created this strange little bubble that is very much detached from the reality of the world that the place that they're in. Montreal is, you know, part of Quebec, which, as everybody knows, is a really sort of complicated place in North America, in Canada, in history, with its relationships with Indigenous people, mm-hmm. with the French-English divide, with all of that stuff. Part of the reason that bubble can exist so vibrant as it is, and it's a really fun place to be part of, is because of things like separatism movements and the rents are lower because of the referendum that go on and sort of investment leaves the province. And so the rent goes down. And so students and poor artists can move in and take up that space. And so it's this strange world where you've got all of these full-grown teenagers in their 20s and 30s playing at artist. Meanwhile, the real world, it's, you know, they're completely separated from the political, geographical, historical circumstances that they're in. They're totally divorced from, you know, working-class Montrealers and Quebecers who are trying to navigate all of these real-world forces that have an effect on their lives. This stuff doesn't really affect these adolescents, and they just continue to, you know, live this sort of summer camp life. And it's a bit of a comment, I think, on that and sort of the whole, I came of age in sort of the height of hipsterism, you could say, and there's this idea of, you know, what is the sort of cohesive mythology of the hipster? It's like irony and this aloof detachment from anything real, and it's, you know, heavy into nostalgia and all of this stuff, which is really divorced from those circumstances, those immediate real world circumstances. So that's definitely a huge part of the book and one of the big things I wanted to look at and sort of comment on as we went through the lives of these characters.
Well, the book is hilarious. It is a comedy. It is something of a satire of that hipsterism you describe, of media culture. There's a very incredible sequence where Milton is actually unknowingly or obliviously successful, becomes this phenomenon, which is interesting. But I want to hop back on the kind of socio-cultural historical work that you're kind of alluding to. But you talk about aloofness and detachment, and there is a historicism within that. You make a point of telling real history here via footnotes, via allusions to characters. Milton, Ontario is inadvertently sort of vaguely named after John Milton, I believe, as I recall. John Diefenbaker is invoked. Yep. Like this, so there's an attachment to real historical incidents and figures. Is the employment of this your way of commenting on what you were just describing? Like, let's actually splash a bit of reality into the face of these wayward characters that are just moving through life, you know, oblivious to all of these things. Was that part of your motivation?
Absolutely, and it it very much comes from my own life too, and trying to figure out who I am, and you know what I'm at in life. You need to sort of reckon with the history. You need to reckon with the circumstances that bring you to this place. And so a lot of those footnotes are just sort of giving background facts and context to some of the historical things that Milton kind of flies by unknowingly or whatever. But also to sort of highlight and underline the fact that there's all of this sort of absurd ignorance of history and erasure of history. And I made him from Saskatchewan, from a rural community in Saskatchewan, a fictionalized community called Belly Button, which is based on a real community where my grandparents grew up called Riverhurst. Mm-hmm. But Saskatchewan for me it's good for making flat and square jokes, but it's also this really blatant symbol of the absurdity of colonialism where, these bureaucrats in Ottawa or London or wherever they dreamed it up first drew a square in the middle of a map of a very unsquare, unflat continent, erased all the history, erased all the people who were already there, and just said, that's a farm now. We're going to occupy it with poor refugees from Europe to keep the Americans out and maintain our interests in this coast-to-coast railroad, basically, and maybe mm-hmm. grow some food while we're at it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a widespread ignorance of that fact, or if it's not ignorance, just sort of ignoring the fact that this history still resonates and still has an impact and still affects people's lives and still hasn't been adequately reckoned with. And there's one footnote in the book where the town Belly Button is on the shores of Diefenbaker Lake, which is a man-made lake from two dams that were built in the 50s and 60s. And there was a sacred meeting place for indigenous people right where the lake was going to be, and it was signified by this great big rock. And at the time, the elders from the indigenous communities asked if that rock could be moved or saved somehow, because it was very important to their communities. And the government said, we can't move a big rock. So they filled it full of dynamite and blew it up, and then gave the chunks of rock to the indigenous people and said, here's a piece of it, and the rest of it will be under the lake if you are looking for it. So just things like that are absurd, that was a thing that happened, but it's, you know, a through line through all of it. And even now, there's so much absurdity going on in the world that I think that needs to be pointed out and commented on. And, you know, satire is a great way to get at that, but also, you know, sometimes facts are much stranger than fiction, and just to utilize both of those to tell the story, but also, you know, put it in context is important.
Beyond sort of telling the people picking up this book and reading it about these facts and highlighting them, is there a part of you that's trying to speak to the communities that are in, like, the specific communities you're talking about here, you know, speaking to those people and letting them know, perhaps specifically, like, you're kind of ignoring this land that you're standing on and working on and living in, living on, you're ignoring this. Like, is there part of you that feels like you're, whatever, subversively, or maybe it's explicit? Are you talking to them on some level to sort of enlighten them?
Absolutely. And part of what I was trying to get at with Milton, and this makes it sound like it's a very serious book, but there's a lot of silliness going on.
I know. I just want to highlight it. It's a very funny, absurd comedy, but there is this amazing undercurrent of meaning and substance to it. So I don't, yes, I want to be careful. But for the record, I love this book. I love it. Love the book.
Thank you.
I felt like fully, I feel like maybe you and I are similar, where we like comedy, we like history, we like facts, we like surrealism, you know, coincidences. Is it a coincidence? Is it fate? I like all of the stuff that's kind of going on. So I just want to put that out there to the people listening to us and to you. So I don't, it's not some somber historical, you know, story on the, I mean, it is, but it's not. Does that help? Have I upsold the book a little
bit? That's perfect. Thank you. The check's in the mail. But back to that question, is part of the reason that I wrote the book that I did was, like I said, and like you got at with all my traveling around and flitting about at different things for all of my 20s and a larger chunk of my 30s, is I wanted to sort of give a witness's testimony to a young, naive, not always the brightest, straight white guy from a fairly privileged middle-class background, trying to navigate becoming a human being in the world. And there's a long history of that kind of person ignoring history, ignoring marginalized communities, ignoring everyone who isn't like them, to the detriment of usually everyone. But we continue to live in a world where people like that, you know, if you look around at most of the world, leaders are still, you know, spoiled, rich, white brats.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, in this country, in this continent, at least for almost 500 years, there's been this history of this kind of person has been given power without question and without consequence, and been able to do whatever they want, usually to the detriment of everybody except for themselves and their, you know, immediate friends or funders or whatever. And that's gone on for a long time. But my interest really stemmed from this idea of, how do you become not a spoiled brat? How do you become not a jerk at this day and age, when brats and jerks continue to be given power, but now not so much all the time without question or consequence, because we've seen, you know, we're 100 years after the women got the right to vote. We're more than a half century past the civil rights movement in the United States. The gay rights movement is, you know, two or three decades old now. We see the Me Too movement picking up, and there's real consequences to that. Before the pandemic hit, the biggest story in Canada was Indigenous blockades of the railroad as part of a protest over pipelines and land rights and things like that.
Yeah.
So the Indigenous rights movement continues to sort of pick up steam, and hopefully it continues to. So all of this stuff is very important, and all of this stuff represents sort of disadvantaged or marginalized groups that had never had their voices heard for centuries, finally getting an opportunity to have their voices heard. And so that needs to continue, and that's absolutely vital and important. And there's so many great spokespeople for those movements, and so much great art and writing and stories coming out of those movements, and they absolutely need to be heard and amplified and shared widely. But then my question becomes, as a person who is not disadvantaged in any way, what's my role in making a world where there's room for those people to live happy, healthy, vibrant lives, to not use my power and privilege to their detriment to accommodate or make room or be a champion for those kinds of things? And basically, how do you become a straight white man this day and age and not be a total jerk? And so that's part of that includes, you know, having to reckon with all of those groups and sort of the consequences of all of the actions of, you know, my father's and grandfather's generations and all those generations before that have created this history and the real world. And so living in a bubble in the heart of a Francophone province, in the heart of a English continent, is very fraught, especially when you consider, you know, the Indigenous communities that also have lived there for millennia and all of these different things that are largely ignored. And even today, they're largely ignored. So I definitely included all of that stuff. I included the historical facts. I included the historical absurdities that sort of highlighted all of this stuff as well, to acknowledge to these marginalized groups that, you know, it's a largely an empty gesture to them, but the same way at a speaking event or something, you would acknowledge the ancestral lands you're on. It was kind of an acknowledgement of those groups in the book, but also a reminder to, if hopefully, you know, folks from a position of privilege will pick up the book as well. And you know, I don't think I'll, you know, enlighten everyone, but hopefully some people can see that, the, you know, these forces are meaningful and important, and they, we all have a role to play in not just having more voices be heard, but people be accepted and made space for.
Well, that's very well put. And as you're speaking, I can see how all of that sort of informs the core of this character, Milton Ontario, who is kind of brilliantly dumb and whose status his status enables him to succeed on some level where he should fail. So a lot, and other things that that caught my attention as you were speaking is that, yes, in this book, there is some clarifying of the record going on. There's some, like, so fact-checking and truth-telling. And I also think there is this, the axiom, you know, beware of false prophets comes up now to me as well. And among the most false prophets that figures heavily in this book is Leonard Cohen, which is an interesting choice. Leonard Cohen is a figure, he's a muse for Milton, but he also ends up playing a role in this book. I don't want to spoil anything, but can you talk a little bit about why you selected, what was it about Leonard Cohen that made you think he could play a role in this story, in Milton's life, and also then become this other type of character?
That's a good question. So Milton's, in the book, Milton's hero is Leonard Cohen, and he goes to Montreal to become like Leonard Cohen, to meet Leonard Cohen. His dream is to sort of become what Leonard Cohen has come to represent for a lot of people. Never mind the fact that he doesn't know if Leonard Cohen's even still alive at that point, and it's set in 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. so he was, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. and Milton ends up meeting Leonard Cohen and things escalate. I don't want to spoil it either.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, much like Saskatchewan's a useful symbol for a lot of the thematic things I wanted to get across in the book and about the character, Milton being from there, Leonard Cohen is as much of a symbol as he was a person, I think, at this point. And
Of Montreal, you mean?
Of a certain type of artist, of a certain type of masculinity. Hmm. Connected to Montreal, yes, in some ways, but also sort of that bohemian kind of bubble in the plateau in Montreal. He's kind of the figurehead of, in a lot of ways, but in his work and in his life, he kind of personified this caricature of a poet. And he was, and he wasn't a poet because he was more successful and got to live the way he lived because he was a pop star in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But his voice was not great. He couldn't sing super well. And his, you know, musically, he wasn't the most gifted, but he was able to use what he had to great effect and very successful. And, you know, on the one hand, I admire him as an artist, but on the other hand, and especially as I, you know, listened to more of his stuff and dug into more of his lyrics and things like that, he's also a little bit silly. Mm-hmm. And yeah. A lot of his songs are kind of icky, and he made great hay out of the idea that he was a ladies' man, and he would tell you almost every song is about him chasing a woman, getting a woman, not getting a woman, and some of them are subtle and some of them are downright offensive. And I think he did apologize before he passed away to Janis Joplin about the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah.
So there's all of these kinds of things of surrounding Leonard Cohen. And one of the things that I wanted to do with using Cohen as sort of a caricature for a type of man in Milton's world, like all the other men in the story that surround Milton, who are all kinds of spirit guides. Or one of his roommates named Naughty is from Newfoundland.
Yeah.
And he's a outrageous character, but he kind of becomes Milton's guide in a lot of ways through a number of events in the book and things like that. But almost without exception, all the men in the book are kind of lousy people, and some of them have redeeming qualities, but their redeeming qualities are usually largely overshadowed by their toxic masculinity or just their general ickiness,
right?
And things like that. And Leonard Cohen, I thought, was a really great example of that kind of thing, where the thing that Milton wants to be the most isn't the healthiest or the thing that he should be aspiring to be, because you don't want to be, in my mind anyways, when it got down to the end of it, you don't really want to be singing these weird, awful songs about the women in your life. I don't think that's fair to the women in your life. And it, you know, once you cut through all the catchiness of the song, you're left with this pretty hollow, superficial message. So there was a lot of, sort of narratively and thematically, there was a lot of material that Leonard Cohen provided, and then using him as a character like I did, he ends up being not a great guy in some ways, yeah. Which is totally fictional. I'm sure he was a lovely person in real life, but just everything sort of lent to that. I wanted Milton to meet him, and I wanted to figure out a way that there could be some tension in that, and I think Leonard Cohen is the caricature like I used him. It's feasible in a way that he could be sort of the baddie that he ended up being in Milton's world. And so it all kind of just worked and made sense for the story I was trying to tell.
Yeah, no, it's beautifully done and fantastical, and I appreciate that. And I did meet Leonard Cohen one time. And
no way.
Yeah, it was in Toronto. There was a tribute to Leonard Cohen that occurred at Massey Hall. And among the people participating, John Prine did a song. Alan Rickman recited a poem, a song, actually. And afterwards, wow. Yeah, it was really heavy. It was really great. And afterwards, there was a get-together at France across the street from Massey Hall. Like, it's like a diner, famous diner. I think it's called France. I hope I'm getting that right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got to go to that. And so I was wearing my journalism hat on some level. So I initially approached Alan Rickman, and or I had his person approach him and say, this gentleman was hoping to get a quote or two from you about this event. And Alan Rickman said, well, you know, tonight's event is about Leonard. Leonard should be the one speaking. I'm not going to say anything. This night's for Leonard. And I said, I appreciate that, Mr. Rickman. I'm a big fan. Thank you very much. We shook hands. That was it. And then a friend of mine, Kate Boothman, said, let's go talk to Leonard. Because Leonard was there watching a band. A band had set up to play in the window. So I got to go meet Leonard briefly. And it was a photo. It was like, wow, a photo opportunity, basically. Like, that's, you didn't really want to bother him, but we went, and I said, hello, Mr. Cohen. My name's Vish, and it's an honor to meet you. And he said, hey, man, it's really good to see you again. Now, I've never seen him before in my life. Hey, man, it's really good to see you again. And I went, yes, thank you. Actually, I'm friends with Howard Billerman, your friend and mine, Howard Billerman. He said, oh, yeah, Howard's great. And that was kind of it. I said, thank you, took a photo, walked away. But I was, I must say, puzzled by, it was really nice to, it's really nice to see you again. And that stuck with me. It was a fleeting instance. But he did not seem like the character that, all I'm getting at is, I met him. Interaction was not a lot like he's, the way he interacts with Milton and others in the book. He seemed nice and kind and maybe forgetful. Maybe he mistook me for someone else. I don't know. Anyway, all this to say, there's something going on in your analysis, in your discussion of these kinds of characters and celebrity culture. Because as you're talking about your perception of Cohen and the unlikely success he had, really, when you talk about some of his skills and some of the things that are, you would think would be detrimental to someone becoming a popular singer. There's a whole sequence, as I mentioned earlier, where Milton becomes successful. But he's also, it's like satire. Like he's successful as a joke almost, actually almost exclusively. And I wonder if that scene, those scenes where he suddenly, you know, inexplicably becomes this phenomenon, is that some kind of comment on the success of someone like Leonard Cohen? Is that a comment on the vapid superficiality of celebrity culture generally? Do you know where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah. It's funny about Leonard Cohen. We could spend days talking about him, but he won a Lifetime Achievement Award or something at some point. And when I was growing up, we had two channels, CBC and CTV, so I got a lot of Leonard Cohen. And it was the Junos or some kind of CBC. It was on CBC, so it was a Canadian award show of some kind. And his entire speech was, only in a country like this can a man with a voice like mine win an award like this.
Yes.
And I, yeah, you nailed it. But yeah, so Milton becomes wildly successful for a little while, and it's absurd, and he's kind of the butt of a joke that he's not entirely in on. And I think it absolutely is this comment on, much like the bubble he finds himself in Montreal, and sort of the ahistorical, you know, a cultural, completely divorced from reality circumstances. This community he's part of is in Montreal. It's much the same way with, you know, the sudden burst of celebrity, where he's got no good talents. His poetry is pretty much utter nonsense, but he becomes this sensation overnight through luck and through people making fun of him and things like this. And it is very much a comment on Leonard Cohen got extremely lucky to become what he became. And so does so many other people who become celebrities for, you know, not entirely of their own merits.
Yeah,
I
think it's a comment on luck and fortune too. Milton leaves Saskatchewan to become a poet.
Yeah.
And that's a one in a trillion shot, like to become a famous, successful poet. And I feel like that's you're commenting on that too. Like that aspect of celebrity is like, it's a bit random. Success in these realms is totally, even the, and I mean, Milton has, it's Leonard Cohen, but he has another muse, a female character that he is becomes extremely smitten with. And she's also like a fledgling artist and also has happenstance success from something that was initially ignored. Like, it's interesting what you're saying, like timing, luck, it has almost nothing to do with talent. It's just, it does, but it can take a while for people to catch on, and it can also be weird the things they catch on to or decide or glom on to decide are interesting. It's weird.
Absolutely. And part of it is that, you know, Milton's on this quest basically to find meaning and purpose and his true, you know, point of life and all of this stuff. And he goes through all these iterations of, he becomes a celebrity, he finds fame, he finds fortune, he finds power, he finds all of these things that he had on his checklist of things I need to become who I want to become, who, you know, Leonard Cohen like character. And he gets all of these things, and just like his wild fame and celebrity, he gets it, it's not what he expected, it doesn't fulfill him in any way. And then like that, it's gone because, you know, I think in the book, Beyonce gets married or something and pushes him off the,
yeah,
the out of the
it's
picture.
It's a comment on media culture too, of course. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, it's fascinating. It's a multi-layered book. And I mean, you mentioned Naughty from Newfoundland. Do you view this book as kind of multicultural? I think of the place that Milton lives in Montreal, this decrepit, horrible flat, or it's not a flat, I guess it's an apartment in Montreal, and I think of the roommates. You seem to be on a, at least some level, this cultural collision thing. Like this milieu in the apartment is fascinating in itself. Was that on purpose for you, like to try to make it, to get Milton from small town Saskatchewan exposed to people from all over the place in terms of Canada at least?
Yeah, part of it was based on who my roommates were in Montreal. It was quite the mix. And it was, the apartment it was a Craigslist. There was like one picture. It was cheap. I didn't get to look at it before I moved there. I moved in. It was about like Milton's experience with it. It wasn't
no way.
Very nice.
Come on. It's incredibly close. Dingy and disgusting in the book. You lived in this?
Basically.
Oh my God.
It was cheap though. It was like $150 a month.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, that's the first house I lived in when I lived in Guelph was the same. And I have nightmares. Yeah. I get the shivers when I think about the kitchen and the bathroom to this day.
And that's the thing is it was this like halfway house for all these sort of halfwits. Not in real life. I lived with some lovely, lovely people.
Sure.
And I totally satirized the extent to how nuts the people were that Milton lived with. So just in case any of them happen to listen, I love them and miss them. But it became this very temporary place that people would come and go. People would live there and you'd never see them because they'd have a partner across town that they'd spend most of their time with. Because why would you want to live in this grimy house? Nobody took responsibility for its upkeep. It was an absentee slumlord who owned it, one of dozens of places that they owned. So if the heater broke, nobody would come fix it for weeks and weeks and things like that. And this bubble in Montreal that I spend a lot of time with Milton in, it attracts these people from all over the place. And a lot of them who Milton sort of doesn't live with directly, but they're in his world, are sort of these suburbanite Toronto, GTA, suburb, I call them refugees. They flee the boring suburbs to come to really exciting Montreal. But there's also the poet wannabe from Saskatchewan and the whatever Naughty is from Newfoundland. He was a strip club DJ in Newfoundland, and he's getting out of that life for something else in Montreal.
Yeah.
They have a roommate from France who's a puppeteer. And so you've got all this really rich diversity, and there's some rich diversity in that bubble, but it's kind of this artificial diversity where it's just a bunch, it's like a reality show. You get these people from all these different walks of life and plunk them together in close quarters, and then watch the fur fly kind of thing. And so it, and just the book, it kind of travels from Saskatchewan to Montreal, and then he does spend time in Newfoundland. And one of the things I learned was kind of foolish in the writing of this was I tried to stick to the dialects and the languages as much as I could, because when you live in Montreal, French is ever present, even if you don't speak it. Most people are bilingual, so they can tell right away. If you don't speak French, they'll speak to you in English, but then there's all this French going on around you.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same with Newfoundland. The language is very much a thing of its own, and it's, there's differences from different parts of the island, and every bay has its own accent. So I tried to capture that too, to give it a little bit of linguistic diversity too, which I don't really speak any of those languages well enough to write in them, so that became a bit of a chore to get that into the book.
I'd say you did well, and now that you're speaking and I'm thinking about the roommates, I can't help but think that each of them are some reflection again of Leonard Cohen. Like, it's weird. You've got the clumsy ladies' man, the kind of theatrical art fuck, Milton. Like, there's something going on there. They're all little personality types that I can kind of, you know, it's kind of funny. I don't know. Did I make that up? I clearly just made that up. Does that resonate with you?
That does. That's a good insight. And yeah. I hadn't sought to do that, but I can definitely see how that works.
Well, Naughty is clearly a ladies man. Like, he's an uncouth, terrible person.
He tries.
Yeah, well, but he seems, based on the stories anyway, he's very proud
That's
of that.
True.
Anyway, very similar to what you were talking about in terms of Leonard Cohen's songs. Like, he's almost exclusively, when he's talking about some encounter he had, let's say, or liaison. And you know, Milton's just like, okay. And Milton sort of aspires to be like that, but also has a... Anyway, we haven't even gotten to the Montreal Mafia stuff, which I'm scared to get into. So we'll just... we'll stop it there, because I don't want to give too much away. This book is very rich. It's very funny. I've learned a lot from it. I loved it. It's called Dirty Birds. And where can people go to learn more about it, Morgan?
They can check out my website. It's morganmurray.ca, and it's got a bunch of links to pre-order the book. It comes out June 29th. Hopefully. We've been delayed a few months because of the pandemic throwing a wrench in things. But morganmurray.ca has got a bunch of links, reviews, interviews, everything you could ever want. And be happy to... for people to check it out.
It's also out on Breakwater Books, so breakwaterbooks.com, right?
Yep.
And your wife, Kate, did the beautiful artwork of the three major locations, I guess?
We were struggling to come up with a cover, and then she spent about 15 minutes and made this gorgeous, gorgeous cover, I'm very lucky.
I appreciate the fact that your wife is legitimately a genius after talking about all these fake geniuses, perhaps. I love this book. What's next for you? Have you had a thought? Like, I'm not sure when you finished this book, but by the way, how many books have you written?
This is the first one.
That's a remarkable debut, I have to say. Reads books, is familiar with books, I know a little bit about books, I've read books. This is astounding. It's a great achievement. You should be very proud, if I might say.
Thank you very much. I learned I should have wrote a shorter book in all in one language, but
from who? Why did you learn that? I disagree.
No, I learned it from myself just in editing.
Oh,
it.
I see.
You have to read the book like 500 times, and so if it's 500 pages, you're going to be doing that a lot. Very proud of how it turned out, and glad with how it looks and everything. And there's illustrations and stuff in it too, which was fun. So I've done that. The next for me is working on a greenhouse in the spare time between child minding. But there's we'll see what the world becomes of this pandemic, because I don't. I was telling somebody the other day that it seems kind of frivolous to write fiction during a global pandemic. So that might influence what I do next, but I got some ideas about different things. And one thing I've always wanted to write about is Stefan Stefansson. I don't know if you've run across him in Alberta yet.
I don't believe so.
So he's, for my money, the greatest Canadian poet who's ever lived.
Oh.
He lived in a little tiny village called Markerville, which is 20 minutes west of Innisfail.
Okay.
Sort of between Calgary and Edmonton. And you've never heard of him because he wrote exclusively in Icelandic. And he's a hero in Iceland. He's but he lived in Alberta from the time he was 20 until he died in his 70s. And he died in the 20s, I think. But a really fascinating character. He's a huge figure in the pacifist movement during World War One, and he was a farmer and a community builder and a homesteader, but he also wrote this crazy poetry. So I'd love to do something about him someday, because he's from my neighborhood, and nobody knows about him, but who knows what that might be.
Okay, so this is just a rough idea at this point.
Very.
Okay. Well, again, the book is Dirty Birds. Morgan Murray, it was a pleasure to speak with you about it, and I congratulate you again, and thank you for this time, and I wish you the best of luck with everything going forward.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much to Morgan Murray for appearing on this, the 551st episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and other things too, like Spotify and YouTube and Stitcher and Radio Public and what have you. If you can't find an episode of the show that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. And a $6 donation or more a month actually gets you exclusive content from my audio archive. So again, to learn more about all of this, go to patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support of this show. Thank you to Jim Guthrie. He lets me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Morgan Murray. I hope you check out his book, Dirty Birds. It's amazing. It's very funny, as you may have heard us discuss. It's great. It's really wonderful. Thank you, Morgan, for being on the show. And you there listening, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you will consider subscribing to the show and checking out some of the back catalog of episodes. And other than that, I will talk to you very, very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.